Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Steven Sakevich. The status of Russia as a world power has been fiercely debated since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. Although often ignored, Russia came back into the international limelight in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea and more recently in 2022 with the war in Ukraine. However, what are the underlying precepts behind Russian behavior on the international stage, and how does Russia's leaders perceive their country's place in it? To answer these questions is the topic of this episode, and we will be discussing the book Russian Grand Strategy in the Era of Global Power Competition, published by Manchester University Press and edited by Andrew Monachem. Dr. Andrew Monachem is a senior associate fellow at the Royal United Service Institute in London. This past spring, he was a George F. Kennan Fellow at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute that specializes in Russian research. He is also the author of a number of books on Russia, including Dealing with the Russians. Andrew Monachem, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Well, it's a pleasure to join you.
Yeah, and very interesting topic of this book in light of recent events as of June 2022. But usually we like to begin by asking our guests to tell us a little bit about your background and how did you get started on working on this book?
Well, the book has come from a relatively long set of, or deep set of roots, I should say. I began all this on studying Russian foreign policy in the early 2000s. And then I started to evolve more towards studying Russian domestic politics. And I started to find really this question of power and strategy and how Russia's role in international affairs also links quite closely with how things do and don't work in Russia. So I started to use the lens of strategy as a means of understanding power and how things work in Russia. And then this question began to fit into the more political question, I suppose, or the more public policy question that really came up in the early 2010s, where is the Russian leadership strategically minded or just making it up as it goes along? Is it an ad hoc leadership? So I thought I would try to offer a long running answer to this long running question. And this is in many ways the second volume. So I had a first stab in mid 2010s, 2017, called Power in Modern Russia, which looked at more of the internal dynamics of strategy power and strategy and power creation. And this is sort of an informal second volume where we try and shift that to a more global horizon.
Now, could you probably quickly summarize for our listeners what do you mean by grand strategy? I know it's a complex topic, but can you kind of... kind of give us a working definition so
we could probably spend most of the rest of the discussion on various debates about this as a whole, not only whether Russia has one or not, but what it actually means. But, so yes, it's much debated, and I sketch it out a bit in the introduction to the book. But what we're really talking about is the creation of power here. The traditional version, of course, traditional definition is the relation of ways and means to achieve political ends. But I try to break that down a little bit in this book, again, as that follow-up to Power in Modern Russia. What we're looking at is three things. First is a leadership's assumptions about how the world is and how it will be. So it's a forward-looking idea. Second, it's the basis. These assumptions provide the basis for policy planning. So the plans that, the leadership then, or the government then, shapes. And then finally, and probably most importantly in terms of real strategy, is implementation. So the execution of this. So it's an executive process. Let's just take this a little bit further. Two things to say is that it's a persistent effort to implement an agenda. So it's not a question of either you have it or you don't. It's in many ways, we are witnessing the rebirth of Russian grand strategy under Putin. It's a long and protracted process, but it's also a difficult process. And nobody who's ever tried to do strategy anywhere throughout history has ever found it easy. It's always been difficult because it's a dynamic and competitive and interactive process that involves dealing with the fog of having to peer into the future on the one hand, but then also the friction, as Clausewitz would say, of trying to implement your plans against a constantly shifting world. And what you're trying to do, therefore, is you're trying to conduct your own internal orchestra, the people, the ministries, the organization, the bureaucracy, and so on. But you're also conducting it in dynamic interaction with external parties, adversaries, allies, neutral states, as well as the opposition of events. So it's a very dynamic and difficult process. That's what we try and use to see what's happening here. I take it a little bit further just by emphasizing this point about policy planning in the book on the one hand, and implementation on the other, that tension between the two of theory and practice.
Now, what are some common mistakes that Westerners make when analyzing Russia? And I can think of two major examples, and you even address this in the book, the introduction. You know, one is that Russia is a power in decline because it's no longer the Soviet Union. And as a result, you know, Russia is just really irrelevant, especially compared to other powers like China or even India. Or the European Union?
Yeah, common mistakes. Well, look, the first thing we have to say is anytime you try to understand another state or an international organization, you know, this is difficult mental gymnastics. There's all sorts of different ways and methods we can use, whether it's political science or whether it's area studies or strategy. It's always difficult. So there are lots of mistakes. But I think we do make three sets of common mistakes. The first is to turn Russia into an abstract. So we have Putin's Russia. And this misses the whole dynamic of how Russia does and doesn't work, how Russia is network politics, a network body politics, how it's teamwork in many ways, how there is a dysfunctional chain of command, and so on and so forth. So it's not this sort of abstract one-dimensional Putin's Russia. Another abstract is, for instance, the more or less ubiquitous after Crimea sense of Gerasimov doctrine, this sort of sense of hybrid warfare. And again, you know, I would ask people, well, tell me a bit about Gerasimov. And they didn't know who he was or what, but it had seeped through an interpretation of a translation of one of his articles. And this became a thing, despite the fact it had almost nothing to do with what he originally wrote or who he was or what he was saying. So this sense of Russia in the abstract is the first one. We talk about doctrines and we name them to people. The second is we turn to analogies. And it usually ends up being the first one to hand, whether it's relevant or not. And this tends to distort and simplify our view of what's going on. I suppose one way of looking at this would be to say that, well, the Russian leadership is like Brezhnev, Putin's like Brezhnev, or Putin's like Stalin, and there are others which we can probably point to, but I won't. This gives us the impression that the Russian leadership is looking back, not forward. And I think this is a mistake, because actually, in many ways, the Russian leadership has been for the last 20 years really looking forward to where we are now. One of the reasons why Russia is able to do what it's doing is because of this long-term horizon of building to a future. And then third is the question of, as you were saying, of Russia in decline. These kinds of things where this is based on very very specific views of some quite out-of-date evidence in many ways. Russia in demographic decline, for instance. There's a whole debate about this, which we didn't go into in this book. But the point is Russia faces bleak socioeconomic outlook. Demography is in decline and so on. This is definitely a view from the 1990s. It's a view that since then the Russian leadership has tried to engage with, and the demographic question is much, much more sophisticated or much more nuanced. So all of this sense of decline is really in the late 2030s or 2040s if it's a demographic question. So this sense of Russia in decline throws our foresight and our thinking about Russia into confusion, because we talk about Russia as a challenge, and then we summon up these scenarios where Russia in decline just disappears from the international horizon, or in some deus ex machina, Russia just seeks reconciliation. So these are three common mistakes I tend to point out. There are more, but this is why we often end up being surprised, because we treat Russia in abstract or in without out-of-date information.
Now, one issue that always kind of comes up with Russia's place in the world is whether or not it's a European or an Asian power, or maybe somewhere a little bit of both. How does the Russian leadership kind of perceive Russia's place in the world in that question?
Oh, yeah. Good question, because this is again, one of those almost entangled cultural, civilizational, political, social questions, which is very difficult and long hammered out in a kitchen over tea and other things. So you'll probably be familiar with this discussion in the 1990s about whether Russia was a part of Europe or apart from Europe. And in many ways, I think the book tries to rephrase that, although implicitly, to frame it as a Europe apart. And that's a question of values and putting it up in opposition to the European Union. But definitely the Russian leadership sees itself as a part of European culture and civilization. Now, there are doubts and debates about that within Russia and outside, but it's certainly there. It's also true that it's an inescapable part of Asia. The lengthy coast on the Pacific and lengthy border with China, obviously deep relationship with Central Asia. And the Russian leadership talks of 21st century being a Pacific century and pivoting to the Pacific. So very strong focus there. And I think though it would be too easy to talk about Russia as positioning itself as a bridge, as a Eurasian bridge. And one of the things that the book tries to do is reshape the language here a little bit to useful terms. So we're not just talking great power, which we can debate all the time, but actually offering not just an east-west, but also a north-south focus here. So that Russia we talk of as a polar power, because it's busy establishing itself in the Arctic, but also driving an agenda in Antarctica. So the word I come up with, or the phrase I come up with in the conclusion to this, is that the leadership is trying to position Russia as a ubiquitous power, not a fully present global power all the time, but a power that's able to deploy its capabilities across the world to be an indispensable part of international affairs.
Now, one part of this ubiquitous power was the importance of maritime objectives shaping Russian grand strategy. And Russia is usually, although it has a navy, it's never usually seen it traditionally as a naval power, particularly like the United States or even Great Britain.
Yeah, yeah. This is one of the pleasures of working on this book as an editor, is I was able to work through and meet and work with a group of real subject matter specialists, and we'll come to this, I imagine, throughout our discussion today. But we tend to think of Russia as a land power, as you say. If we're talking in geopolitical terms, which the Russian elite often does these days, we think of Russia as a continental power, and there's much to this. But Moscow every year emphasizes that Russia is also one of the world's leading sea powers. I think this is a really interesting aspect that we try to come to terms with in the book as well. It gives it, I think, a fresh angle. Because Russia not only has a long history of maritime exploration, not very long ago, Putin was celebrating Russia's maritime discovery of Antarctica, for instance, but also the exercises in the high north in the Arctic, UMCA exercises. Russia obviously has very long coastlines on the one hand, and has to try to manage this, partly in terms of security, for instance. But also, much of Russian export goes out by sea. So Russia, in many ways, is a maritime export economy, which we don't tend to think of in this sense. So I think the Russian leadership is aware of, and we talk about this in the UK. I know that this is discussed a lot in the US and elsewhere. There is a maritime turn in international affairs. And I think that Russian leadership understands this as well, is trying to be part of this, And it's both an economic and a security question. If as I say, the economics go out by sea, much of economic export goes by sea, but the wars that Russia has lost in the past have tended to be against maritime powers. Japan, the UK, or Great Britain, or British Empire, as it was at the time. And then, of course, in the Cold War as well, the threat from the US and the UK and NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So deliberately, we try and reshape this so that Russia is not just a continental power, but is much more ubiquitous, as I say, and within that, there's a maritime turn.
Now, focusing more on the security and military aspects, what have been like the major developments within the Russian Navy since the collapse of the Soviet Union that continue on to this day?
Well, this is one of those timely questions I think that hopefully the book sets up, because we're seeing it really right now in the war in Ukraine. The overall debate since the early 1990s has been shaped by shortage. So the Russian Navy has been in decline more or less since it came into existence, if not before it came into existence. So the 1990s was chronic shortages of funding, of personnel, of training, of everything. And this rendered it slightly lopsided in certain ways. New vessels did arrive, but much more obvious were the outgoing vessels in terms of the decommissioning. This has shaped a continuing debate over the nature of what kind of Navy Russia now needs, whether it's surface vessels, whether it's submarines, what they should emphasize, the role of that Navy, should it be ocean going, should it be large ships and aircraft carriers. So in fact, we've got four or five debates going on here. In fact, I think the priorities will continue to lie in strategic deterrence and in submarines. And what we've tended to see, though, is substantial investment through the 2010s, with efforts to deploy further afield across the world. We could talk about the flotilla off Australia in the G20 in 2014. We could talk about the Admiral Gorshkov circumnavigating the world, I think, in 2019, and so on. So we see a global approach here, which we'll come back to later, where the Russian leadership wants to deploy its forces capably across the world, not just be there, but capably across the world. And then second, you have this sense of the Russian Navy fitting in as a war fighting entity. So there isn't, this is one of the differences we have with Russia. There's no real such thing as a naval strategy in Russia. The naval component is always a part of the broader military effort. And you see that now with the Russian Navy bombarding and blockading Ukraine and dominating the Black Sea. Oh, incidentally, we should bear in mind, just to add to that, it's not just what's happening in the Black Sea. Of course, Caspian Sea flotilla is also involved in bombarding Ukraine. So this is part of that sense of a global horizon and a linking of different regions, while we also still have the threat of submarines and strategic capability. So the Navy plays quite a big role in this. And for me, as I say, the pleasure of working with these colleagues was we could delve into these issues in more depth. But I think that the naval aspect is one that's really overlooked in Russian strategic planning. And a lot of this is where Russia, with problems, is trying to assert itself as a maritime power in the 21st century.
Yeah, and another capability that Russia has been developing that's mentioned in the book is its map-making capabilities and how that serves grand strategy purposes. Can you explain this in detail?
Yeah, sure. This is one of those parts where we're trying to separate. Look, there's a lot of things, I must say, we don't cover in the book in terms of the usual things that we would look at. So, we don't look at NATO-Russia relations. We don't look at US-Russia relations, the sort of standard fare. But I think we're trying to offer something slightly different here by building up a view of how the Russian leadership thinks it sees the world, and frames its view of the world. And we have one of the very happy contributions is by Alex Kent, one of the world's leading geographers and cartographers. He's contributed this chapter building through the Soviet capability first, demonstrating how that became the most comprehensive global cartographic project of the 21st century. And he shapes that to begin with. And then he shows how the Russian leadership has invested to try to take that forward. So he calls his chapter "The Revolution in Russian Geospatial Capabilities," which I think gives you already that sense of the importance in Russian thinking. 2 points. First, it's that aspect of Moscow's mental map, if you will, or mind view of the world. I mean, it's called mental map in some of the academic literature, so maybe let's stay with that. This, again, is that emphasis that this is not a Euro-Atlantic question for Russia. This is a global horizon. So global thinking and a global horizon is mapped out now by geospatial capabilities, GLONASS and reconnaissance satellites and so on. But this global horizon shapes its planetary scope of thinking, but also military geography. And we're talking about information, real-time information in war, contribution to decision-making. So this chapter offers three things in many ways. It draws on that longer term thinking through of how first the Russians, then the Soviets, then the Russians again have this long tradition of mapping the world, of exploration and trying to shape information about the world. Second, how the current Russian leadership links relations. And third, that geospatial capability for decision making.
Now, you did mention the Gerasimov doctrine earlier, and this kind of ties in with what the book calls Russian conceptions of sixth generation warfare. Can you explain that concept for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. This is one of those questions when you come back to that good question you asked earlier of what are the main mistakes that we've made? I mean, we're obviously for human reasons appalled and shocked by what's happening in Ukraine at the moment. But I think part of that is also sort of a doctrinal surprise that we'd rather written off what real war means particularly in Europe. And we talked for the last nearly for a decade about how the Russian military prioritized non-military measures, and even how the Russian military, through this so-called non-existent, it must be said, Gerasimov doctrine, how the Russian military's main emphasis was now moving away from violence. I mean, not only is this ahistorical in terms of the Russians almost always relying on heavy firepower, but it's also not what the Russian leadership has been talking about for the last decade. In fact, a lot of what the Russian leadership has been talking about is indeed war as a transition to armed force, as something that's characterized by armed violence and by lots of firepower. So the main concerns for the Russian military as they've been thinking through this are actually global focus and really the primary delivery of US, primarily the US delivery of power across the world. So perhaps the two main things that have been discussed implicitly and explicitly in the Russian debate have been Gulf War I and 21st century version of Blitzkrieg. Now, I think if we'd paid more attention to this discussion, very explicit and public discussion, we would have a slightly more realistic grasp of how the Russians go to war. Let's break this down a little bit. You ask about sixth generation warfare, because this is really Russian war thinking. And of course, this is how it would affect a question of war with NATO, war with the US or the UK. This goes all the way back to the Falklands War in many ways, but accelerates through Gulf War I and into the Iraq War in 2003. It comes from a debate about the future of war, changing character of war, from a general, the late General Slipchenko. And he picks up effectively six generations at that time. This is through the 1990s. Six generations of war. The first is edged weapons. Second is gunpowder. Third is rifled weapons. Fourth is automatic weapons. Fifth is nuclear weapons. The sixth generation, then, he talks about is really long-range precision-guided weapons and non-contact warfare, where you're really targeting the leadership. And the point was that he demonstrated how effectively, this was information age warfare against industrial age warfare, as demonstrated first sort of in the Falklands War and then particularly in 1991. So that's that point that it becomes, again, we start to think about information as central to war. And that information is not just information psychological, but information technical. And what the Russians call information technical, which is about precision guiding capabilities. So sixth generation warfare really talks about information being central to this and striking from a distance. Again, what we're talking about is a question of global horizon, extended theories of theaters of military activity and a planetary form of warfare where, in which range and speed are essential. There are blurred lines between strategic, operational, and tactical, and blurred lines between the offensive and defensive. Again, it must be said that as so often with the Russians, theory is ahead of capability by many years. To be fair to Slipchenko, he talks about seventh generation warfare, which is warfare on a global scale, again, of disrupting the planet's information domain and information assets. But this is likely only by 2050. So, I mean, the one thing I would add to this, sorry for the long answer, but I hope it's, you know, this clarifies some of the
No, you're doing fine.
Russians think about war. The one thing I would add to this is that even if you fight a sixth generation warfare, parts of that war, if you're ready for sixth generation warfare, parts of that war, or a war that you fight, can be characterized as an earlier generation. And we're sort of seeing that blurring now in terms of what's happening in Ukraine, which might well be, in effect, also a fourth generation war.
That's very fascinating. In fact, your answer kind of reminded me about the revolution and military affairs debates of the 1990s. Yes. And how that was originated in the 1970s with the Soviet military thinkers about how technology and information was going to be changing the battlefields of the future. So in some ways, it was only in the 90s that we kind of caught up with that concept. So,
I mean, that, you know, it's a slightly different question, but that takes us right back. You know, we can trace this right back even to the 1930s, 1920s, and even 1914. There's that constantly evolving question, the changing character of war that the Russians and then the Soviets, and then again the Russians study, exactly as you say, that revolution in military affairs, which is what we call it over in here in the Euro-Atlantic community. The Russians keep trying to think about this, and really Ogarkov in the 70s and early 80s was talking in many ways about the capabilities he wished he had, and we're now seeing Gerasimov and others try to create that.
Yeah, and I guess for clarification with the Gerasimov doctrine, or the speech from which that term is derived, he actually kind of said that Russia was the victim of supposed hybrid warfare from the West, that not that Russia needs to target the West with that. That's usually a common mistake I see when people analyze that.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, what I do think we need to be clear about is what he's really talking about is what is the cutting edge of war? Now, this is part of Russian military science, which, you know, we haven't really dug into since the Cold War days. And part of the point of this chapter is to create that, again, that sense of continuity and evolution and planning and thinking about things which go into that persistent strategic approach. But the when you see these articles that are put out to shape the debate, what you see is how the Russians see the cutting edge of war, both in terms of it being a threat to them, but also what they need to be doing. And this is what I think is quite interesting in terms of how we go about understanding the Russians adopting lessons from elsewhere and trying to transplant it onto their own system, but also then shaping through their own military history experience their own concepts. And this question of military strategy is something I'm working on quite a lot at the moment, but it's something we've tended to overlook almost entirely over the last decade, which is one of the reasons why we've slightly, I think, misframed and misjudged what's been going on.
Yeah, from my own experience, I've noticed this general issue just since the fall of the Soviet Union, where, again, as we discussed earlier, the whole notion of Russia being irrelevant, so we don't need to pay attention to them at all, but they're actually pretty forward thinking, and even in areas quite unrelated to the military. I mean, I do research in big history, and there's even a whole Russian school of big history with social evolution, which is pretty revolutionary in the field. So it's just kind of pointing to this fact that, you know, Russia's not that irrelevant. Moving on. Kind of continuing on with this, how important are information warfare operations in Russian military strategic thinking, especially related to the sixth generation war or even the seventh generation that you mentioned earlier?
Information is absolutely central to this. And again, we see it, percolating through the entire concept of how Russia thinks about war. And again, there is that distinction that they make between information psychological, which we might think of as propaganda, misinformation, disinformation, and so on, but then information technical, which involves the more practical side, which is really real-time information to affect decision-making and in terms of reconnaissance, targeting, and then striking. So I think this underpins a lot of how Russia approaches war. It's very similar. We could indeed understand this as network-centric warfare. The Russians themselves spend a lot of time talking about this. We've tended to focus on information psychological. There are a few honorable exceptions, including our esteemed contributor to the book, Charles Bartels, who have looked at Russian information technical and so on. But this point about information is essential, again, with those two brackets of psychology, because every effort is made, rightly or wrongly, successfully, unsuccessfully, every effort is made to undermine the adversary before they go to war. So information psychological is essential. And then once you start to move into the deployment of military campaigns, then you have that question of the need for speed and dynamism. So real-time information. And that's a bit what comes back to Alex Kent's chapter about global mapping and geospatial capability and so on. So this is, I hope that a sort of integral idea is starting to take shape between how these chapters all link together, about the creation and the organization of assumptions, but also of planning and then the execution.
Well, that's a real good strength of the book, is how all these different elements are kind of tied in together. And one chapter kind of discusses one area that's often neglected in Russian analysis, and that is Russia's strength as an economic power. And is Russia often underestimated in this sphere?
This is, again, I like these kinds of questions, because one can then start to respond, start to blur the answer between to something that's quite, I find personally quite interesting. But the answer is the Russian economic strength underestimated? Well, no, because there's no way we can really talk about Russian economics as dynamic or innovative or strong. At the same time, in many ways, yes, it is, because it's certainly not as easy as all that, and depends a little bit on how you measure it. And this isn't some sort of, you know, economist's tweak to shape something. This is purchasing power parity, which is widely used as a measure, and a very good use of measuring actual economic strength rather than market exchange rates. And this reminds us that A, the Russian leadership has much more money to spend on its agenda than we think otherwise. So defense spending, for instance, is much more substantive than it would be if we did it in market exchange rates. But it also reminds us that on purchasing power parity, Russia is currently, okay, we'll see what happens with the economics, the sanctions and so on, currently the sixth in the world, and the second largest behind Germany, and fluctuating alongside Germany and Europe for being the largest in Germany. So it is underestimated in some senses, because we don't really see those indicators when we hear it being compared to the economy of Portugal or Italy or some such. But in fact, really what we're looking at is a set of strategic bases that the Russian leadership has tried to shape, which is hydrocarbons, weapons, of course, nuclear power plants, export, and grain. So the Russian economy has a number of strategic bases, even if it's not dynamic or innovative. And as Richard Connolly, the author of the chapter here, calls, I think he's called it an archipelago economy, areas of some real substantive strength and some areas of weakness, let's call it. An important dynamic in this is that the Russian macroeconomic leadership has been actually rather good. You know, we can talk about the Russians failing in many ways to foresee economic declines. The Russian economy has been in recession in many ways, and collapses in 1998 and 2008 and so on. And this is true, but it matched against a lesson learning macroeconomic leadership that has tried to build funds and has successfully built funds for a rainy day. And it's a big rainy day at the moment. You know, they built $630 odd billion of foreign exchange reserves before the war. Now that's, you know, Russia has very limited debt externally, well, it does have some, but it's very limited. So it built this economy. Russian leadership built this economy that was designed to be defendable against economic statecraft.
Yeah, in fact, I was just even recently reading about how the ruble is the strongest currency in the world against the dollar, you know, as a result of the sanctions. And I was kind of thinking, that's kind of interesting. Yeah,
the fluctuations that we see, you know, and you know, with the sanctions, with the economic sort of the big waves that you see going on economically, you know, the Russian income was more this April than it was last April, significantly more. As far, you know, so we have to be quite careful when we talk about Russia's economic strength, because there's a lot of weakness, and no one could underestimate that scale of weakness in many ways. But at the same time, there's a big area of capability and strength, and I think that part of the Russian leadership's intention was to be able to cope with, as we'll come on maybe to talk about a bit later, cope with a decade of geoeconomic competition.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of that phrase by Michael Kaufman: "Russia is never as strong or as weak as it appears." You know, it's always it's kind of like that twist on the old saying about it being an enigma to us. Yeah. And what role does armaments trade play in Russia's place in global security? Because, of course, we've been talking about the military, and of course, that still remains one of the big strong areas of the Russian economy.
Yeah, definitely. I think, well, it's probably clear to many that Russia is the second largest arms exporter behind the US internationally. So it's a very substantial exporter. But I think one of the things I'd like to try and do is emphasize that arms is just one part of a broader set of exports. Now, what we talk about in the book is a supplier of strategically important goods. So weapons or arms is one of them, but we're also looking at hydrocarbons, nuclear power plants, and grain. And so, you know, hydrocarbons, I think people are probably very familiar with Russia's position as the major exporter of hydrocarbons. Weapons probably too. One of the big surprises over the last few years is Russia's emergence as one of the leading grain exporters, if not at certain times the leading exporter of grain on the global market.
Yeah, even in recent news, that's become
right up in the news today. Exactly. And people, this is one of those things that has happened over the last decade, and in some sense it's the result of the first round of sanctions. You know, if we were to talk about exports and imports, in many ways the first set of sanctions that were put on Russia obliged leadership to impose import substitution and to sustain the domestic agriculture business. And one of the longer term aspects of this is that Russia is then able to export grain. Imagine, even before COVID, Russia was competing with France in terms of exporting grain to North Africa. I mean, it's some really interesting parts come out of this. So arms, absolutely, you're right. This is an important aspect. I think it's really interesting that this is one of five strategically important goods that the Russian leadership is deliberately and explicitly, and has over the longer term planned, sought to diversify and reach into the developing world, as we might have called it during the Cold War era, but as we would look at it now, as the Indo-Pacific, the Middle East and North Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa. Now, as we reshape our view of the world, the Russian leadership looks at this in slightly different ways. They still call it Asia-Pacific, but they emphasize the Middle East and North Africa. So building a relationship with Turkey, for instance. Turkey imports Russia is a strategic supplier, i.e. more than 10% of all five of these strategically important goods. I think China currently has three, but is about to go to five. India too, growing. You look at Iran, you look at Bangladesh, for instance, other states in that era that show the importance of diversification and influence being shown across the world, that global horizon. That for me is what's particularly interesting. And you could also talk about Russian grain to the Gulf. So this economic picture for me is one of surprising strength, let's call it that. Acknowledged weakness, but some surprising strength. And again, that's that question of planning that has evolved over actually nearly 20 years of deliberate efforts to diversify its markets, deliberate efforts to reach into growing markets and not rely on saturated markets, and a deliberate effort to establish political influence. In many ways, I think this is about driving what the Russian leadership has called a post-West world, driving what the Russian leadership sees as a structural shift in international affairs, and is returning to that point about mental maps and how the horizon is seen as global, regional connectivity, so the Atlantic connected with the Pacific, the high north connected with the Indian Ocean. For me, this is one of the most interesting aspects of Russian strategy. We're talking about geoeconomics rather than geopolitics.
Yeah, and that kind of made me think of the contrast with the Soviet Union is that there isn't as much ideological constraints on Russian efforts around the world, whereas they don't have to support, we can only support fellow communists, but it's almost like, well, anyone who's on our side, we can support.
Yeah, I mean, when you start to see the maps, there, as you'll have seen, and as readers of the book will find, there are a number of, we've tried to illuminate some of this, not just text, but with maps and graphs and so on in the book. You start to see how the world is shaded differently. And that point of a post-West world, and it really talks to the idea of Russian foresight and to out to 2020 and 2030, which is that shifting structure in international affairs, the rise of the East, the emergence of a Pacific century, the impact, oddly enough, of things like climate change. Yeah.
Now, how does Russia kind of balance itself between non-Western markets, which you delved into just a moment ago, and also Western markets? And of course, I know recent events have kind of shifted the dynamic a bit, but if you can illuminate on that issue.
Sure. I mean, we have, I think in many ways, the current situation is a continuation of what we were talking about in the book. In two particular chapters, both economics and energy, is a demonstration of these long-running themes that the Russian leadership has been trying to play into. Now, as you probably know, and your listeners maybe know, that the actual US-Russia economic relationship was quite small, but Europe's relationship with Russia is much, much larger. Even so, really what we've been seeing over the last decade or so is a significantly growing relationship with states in what Moscow still calls Asia Pacific region. So significant growth in relations, economic relations with China, with India, and so on. So really you see this shift and growth in trade, not so much a growth in trade with Europe, although energy did rise and grow over the energy trade did grow over the last decade, but much more growth towards the East. The energy question is really an important one for this, because as I say, the book talks about geoeconomic competition, and this really began with a concern that the United States was starting to compete for Russia's traditional energy markets. So this binds economic issues and energy issues on the one hand with national security, as is made clear in strategic documentation. So the effort when the US started to export its own hydrocarbons and increase the export to Europe, this was determined in Moscow as an attempt to break into Russian traditional markets, to take over Russian traditional markets. Now, because the budget is largely sustained by hydrocarbon exports, this is seen as a challenge to the budget. And a challenge to the budget is a national security question. So all of what you see now is playing into what the Russian leadership sees as geoeconomic competition. So the cancellation of Nord Stream, Nord Stream 2, which has been built through over a number of years, as we know, the final cancellation of that, again, goes to demonstrate this purpose that the Russian leadership sees itself, I think, as being proven right about this geoeconomic challenge. And again, the increasing sense of moving to diversify a market out to Asia Pacific is therefore growing.
Now, the book makes mention of the so-called national champions of the Russian economy. Who are these national champions?
Well, really, what we're talking about are the hydrocarbon In my view, what we're talking about in hydrocarbons. Now, there are a couple of others that that might sneak under the radar, sort of Al Rosa, for instance, in mining. And you know, we've got some agriculture, grain and agricultural parts. We've got the arms export and so on. But really what we're looking at here is, in my view, is Rosneft, Gazprom, and particularly Novatek. So Novatek is the company that was charged with developing Yamal LNG in the high north. And that for me is really the national champion that is perhaps most underrated. We see the hydrocarbon ones, the big hydrocarbon beasts, but I'd add to that Novatek.
Now, earlier you mentioned Russia as an Arctic power, and the Arctic region features very prominent in Russian interest, particularly because of the Northern Sea Route. Can you explain this for our listeners?
Sure, because this is, to my mind, this is the Russian priority for the 21st century. And I mean, yes, it's an Arctic power. I would just emphasize that, re-emphasize the point I made earlier, thinking about Russia as a polar power. I mean, Russia, obviously, the geography is explicit and it's clear about Russia in the Arctic, and I'll come back to that in a second. But an interesting effort is being made to enlarge Russian presence and develop Russian presence in Antarctica too. So, you know, the book tries to argue that, you know, reshaping that our thinking about Russia as Russia as an East-West question, as a Euro-Atlantic question, perhaps. Actually, it's much more of a polar question, because the poles are the fundament of the important aspects of how Russia sees 21st century: hydrocarbons and navigation. These are, I think, in navigation, of course, and information. These are the driving factors of this. And when one comes to this idea about the Arctic, so it's another really good example of Russia not being ad hoc in the least, the Russian leadership having lots and lots of plans. So there's a whole web of strategic plans set out for the development of the Arctic, not just, I mean, originally through planned in the, we could say, the mid-2000s. You'll remember the effort, the dropping of the flag, perhaps, in the Arctic under the pole there in 2007. But the web of plans, strategic plans that were developed that decade, shaping out to 2020. New plans recently adopted, shaping Russia's agenda out to 2035. These are state plans. These are state company plans. And there's a whole web there, some of which, you know, you have to say are sound committee based, and some of which are a little bit optimistic, and some of which are too detailed. And you know, there's plenty of flaws in them. But the whole point is that it demonstrates where the Russians think they're going to go with this. And because it's their number one priority, internal development. We're talking about, obviously, Russia retaining its hydrocarbon position. That's going to be the fundament of its economy for the foreseeable future. But as a result, it's also about investment and development. So, you know, what we see really is the attempt to convert the Northern Sea Route over a period of, where are we, 2022, over a period of 15 years or more into Russia's internal waterway that can then be used as Russia's transit route and develop, you know, I think Putin said by 2024, 80 million tons of trade going through it. This is seen to be as part of the changing international structure, alternatives to Suez Canal, alternatives to the long maritime routes around through the Indian Ocean, a means of connecting Europe to the Asia Pacific region. So high priority. And there's an excellent chapter by Nazrin Medyeva in the book talking about how much of this is both security oriented and commercial. That attempt to try to create, to treat Russia as an internal waterway has commercial attributes, but also security attributes. And delving into all the different Russian actors who become involved in trying to shape this priority and this strategy. So for me, it's a good case of strategy in action.
Now, getting to the security aspect of this question, is Russia kind of seeking or expecting a confrontation with the West in this region, in the Arctic regions at all?
Yeah, this has been one of the transformations through the 2010s. Originally, probably until the middle of the decade, perhaps, I suppose we could hammer out a specific date, but really through until the middle of the decade, I think there was an effort to say, no, this is more about cooperation. You know, we work together and so on. And of course, Russia has recent role as the chair of the Arctic Council. really what we're seeing, though, is much more focus now towards competition, using it as a tool for competition, and less having it as a commercial trade route for all kinds, more prioritizing it for Russian companies only. You know, there's legislation now about foreign warships, limited activity through it, and so on and so forth. So there's a shift towards it being seen as competitive now rather than cooperative.
Yeah, and you were kind of talking about like how the Russian government always has these different plans, and the book talks about this concept of strategic planning. What is strategic planning in the Russian view?
Yes, so this is something that, you know, we could have one of those long discussions again about going back to the Soviet era and, you know, the role that strategic planning played in here. Let's take it from the early 90s. Even in the early 90s, typically there was a question of an attempt to focus on strategic planning. This, in my view, and I think in the view of the author of the chapter, really, we take this from the mid-2000s. So yes, there was some capability in the 1990s. Yes, there was an intent to do it, but really things have started to take shape under Putin. And there are now hundreds, indeed, depending on how you want to value some of them, thousands of forecast concepts, strategies, programs, and so on that really try to shape government and Kremlin work. And this is based on that part I came back to at the beginning, defining strategy, which is about the long-term assumptions, or the assumptions heading out into the future, onto which you then try to build plans, which you can then use to drive resources and focus resources onto implementing the plan. What you see is, since the mid-2000s, the creation of a planning architecture. So there's an attempt to try to legislate, on the one hand, to create foundations of strategic planning, as Julian Cooper goes into in the chapter, but you also have the added emphasis of the growing role of the Security Council. The Security Council is the body that oversees drafts and then oversees drafts of, and then oversees the implementation of these plans. And this is really one of the main bodies for Russian strategic planning, I think. So you have this dual approach of both legislation and architecture taking shape in Russia for strategic plan.
Yeah, that almost makes me remember, I think it was Stavka during World War II, where they kind of had something very similar to that. Were they kind of trying to model it on that, or is this kind of a completely new idea that they had?
Let's call it, we can actually be explicit about this, because the one of the bodies that has been built and opened is the National Defense Management Center, which is one of a network of situation centers across Russia that are built through the Security Council, built through the presidential administration as well, but also through the government and also presidential plenipotentiary. So these situation centers reach out to a distributed network of bodies that try to create an automated information system that offers strategic analysis and monitoring and so on, shaping of priorities and coordination of bodies. The most obvious one is the National Defense Management Center. And that is explicitly stated, that the head of the National Defense Management Center said, we modeled this on the Stavka. So, you know, wherever you go, and it's probably a little bit different in the UK and the US these days, but wherever you go in Russia, you can't escape history, even when you're looking to the future. So, I mean, the example I love to give here, which hopefully illuminates this trajectory for our audience, is this National Defense Management Center is supposed to be the highest, the highest quality, new grade technological development, everything you could possibly want for a 21st century organization in Russian defense. The rooms are all named after great heroes, so Suvorov, Zhukov, and so on and so forth. So there's that trajectory, which the book is trying to get at, of past influencing the present, and the importance of history, and even the inheritance of history, but still we're looking to the future. That's that point about strategic planning. And of course, there's lots of disagreement within the system. You know, there's disagreements, as Julian Cooper makes clear. I mean, as all of the chapters make clear, there's disagreement and dissonance within the system, but between the economic bloc, particularly, and the security bloc. So there is an imbalance within planning, and there is ongoing dissonance there too. So this is that part of that problem about strategy and consensus, and, as I said, conducting the orchestra.
Now, what in your view is the geopolitical future for Russia, especially considering the ongoing war in Ukraine right now?
Well, it's if we take this as the book tries to, from Moscow's mental map in Russian strategic planning, we're seeing the plan play out, I'm afraid. With all the flaws and problems that one might expect of having bumped into, you know, unpredictable elements and so on. But I mean, let's take the pandemic, which we've just had. The Russian leadership and many Russian experts were explicit about how this demonstrated that their foresight over the last decade is now coming true. A crumbling world, a world in disorder, and a world in... So much of this, if we go back to the energy question, if we go back to the sanctions, we go back to this sense of geoeconomic competition from in the 2020s, which they've been talking about already for some years. And again, if you listen to both Russian experts, but also the Russian leadership, you understand that Ukraine is considered by them, by many there, to be the first salvo in a decade of competition. So the current war in Ukraine, regardless of whether the Russian military leadership or the Russian leadership calls it a special military operation or what they specifically call it, the current war in Ukraine is the great power competition that we've talked about for 5 years made real. Moscow is explicit about this. What do I think about what's happening? The cost for Russia is extremely high. I think it's extremely high in terms of most importantly, human life. I think it's going to have huge economic ramifications for the development of Russian and Russian socioeconomic conditions. And of course, it has substantive reputational, and it's having substantive reputational consequences. So the cost across every area is very high. Let's bear in mind, though, that some of what we were talking about earlier, the initial foundations for the Russian leadership are holding quite strong. China and India have not come out against Russia. They've not cut them off. Energy prices, the Russian income in April was higher than it was last year. So in the immediate term, the initial foundations are holding strong for Russia. Diplomacy, the Russian leadership is being very active diplomatically out to the Gulf, into Middle East and North Africa, and so on and so forth. And Putin met the president of the African Union recently. So a great deal of activity going on there. But I think really the trajectory over the next 3 to 5 years is very rocky for Russia. And it must be said, therefore, rocky for us. Because whether we're in European Union Europe, whether we're in the UK, whether we're in the US, the costs are very high, and this is not a question of Russia simply flubbing this, you know, making a mess of it, and therefore it's not something we need to consider. This is, as I say, unfortunately, this is the great power competition made real, and it's going to be a very unpleasant experience, but I think for everyone involved.
Now, what in your view is the best way for, say, NATO countries to deal with Russia in light of what you just said about how it may be rocky for both us and Russia?
Well, I mean, look, we're going to have, I suppose, two sets of discussions here. The first is about NATO's actual intervention, and the second is how we go ahead looking at this, the nature of this challenge. And as you know, and as everyone who's been reading the news, there's a strong line of argument saying NATO should have become involved to establish a no-fly zone. NATO should now be becoming involved to break the blockade that Russia is imposing on Ukraine and so on and so forth. This, of course, I mean, everyone who understands, who calls for this, I hope understands that what this means is that intervention would raise the level of fighting to what the Russian military leadership and therefore state leadership would define as a regional war. Now, I know this sounds like a semantic question, but this actually brings in different categories of weapons. So this is already level thinking of two different on two different levels. And people often ask about the nuclear question. At the moment, I don't think this is part of the Russian leadership's calculations. If it becomes a regional war, then weapons of mass destruction are part of Russian military strategic thinking. So, you know, we have to bear in mind that if we do those things, what that means is that it will involve opening fire on Russia, It will involve Russia opening fire on us. And what we have seen is essentially Russian ground forces struggle to impose their will, and in some cases, certainly facing tactical defeats and struggling. But what we haven't seen is the weaponry that Russia would actually plan to use against us. None of that remains in any way. None of that has been degraded substantively. We still have the questions of their submarines and their nuclear deterrence and so on. So any question of an intervention that actually involves active participation in the conflict has to bear that in mind. Second, and that's going to be very difficult to create NATO consensus on, I think, as a result. The second is, I think that we must bear in mind Russia is as an adversary through to 2030, so we'll see much more focus on NATO's strategic concept. I would like to see that NATO actually not underestimating the nature of the challenge. There's a big debate, you might have seen it, and our audience might have seen in the news. Maybe it's a bit specialist, I don't know at the moment, but this debate about how we overestimated Russian military capability before the war, and now the war is underway and the Russians have taken heavy casualties and lost of kit. We're now overcorrecting, and now we're now treating Russia as not a challenge at all. I think this is to underestimate the nature of the challenge that Russia is posing to us. I think it, as I say, it hasn't used its strategic capabilities. So I think we do now have to think of these in global terms, a little bit like I set out in the book. I think we have to bear in mind what horizontal deterrence looks like, what vertical deterrence looks like. We have to learn from this war, not just that our doctrine is right and the Russians' doctrine is wrong. So suddenly we've gone from Russia as a hybrid challenge to Russia as a warfighting challenge. So that requires a big intellectual shift, I think. You'll note I haven't advocated for NATO intervention. I've merely said that if there is that, then it has to be done with the deliberacy of forethought. I don't think that we're there yet with the deliberacy of forethought to know what that might look like.
Yeah, that kind of gets back to our first question about just how often we get Russia wrong. And I've noticed a lot of analogies to the Winter War of 1939, where the Finns kind of made some tactical successes against the Red Army. But I mean, what people seem to misunderstand is the Red Army still won. They just won it with more casualties than they expected. Yeah. And of course, Hitler also underestimated the Red Army. He said, you only have to kick in the door and the whole rotten structure will come in. And then that led to Barbarossa. And as we kind of know, that didn't turn out well. So it just kind of goes back to that one saying, Russia is never as strong or as weak as she appears. And, it's almost like, yeah, they might falter in this one area, but even kind of, as you said, with the economy, they're faltering in some areas, but in other areas, they're kind of showing some strength.
I think this is, your point about the Winter War is a really interesting one, because when we think about Russian warfighting, the Russian political leadership very rarely gives the military a good starting point. And if we think about the Winter War, your point is a valid one, that the political leadership planned it first. It was pretty disastrous in many ways, and a huge, appalling cost of human life. But then they reorganized. They handed over command to the military, and the military gnawed through and achieved what they intended. But there is a little bit more to this, that the Russian thinking about war is war is a political question. It's an attempt to resolve the policy clash, and you have therefore a spectrum within that. You have the full resolution, full and final victory on the one hand, which is the permanent resolution of the policy clash, but you can have everything underneath that. So a military victory or military defeat that doesn't resolve the policy clash means that the war will roll on. And of course, we only actually have a resolution to the Finnish war years later, after the end of the defeat of Nazi Germany and the defeat at the same time of Finland. So, and then the policy question is resolved. So what we're seeing is an extended set of fighting between Moscow and Kiev on the one hand, that I suppose you could argue began in 2014. Some might say that that's a bit late. Some might say it's a bit earlier, given the color revolution 2004. But But what you're seeing is this renewed bout of fighting. And the more that the Russian leadership starts to equate this with a war with NATO, I think the longer you see this, you see really all of their what they've been talking about and preparing over the last few years come to pass. And we need to be a little bit careful about waiting for Putin to die, as you probably see in the headlines that Putin's very ill, waiting for the people to rise up against him. Actually, there seems to be quite a strong sense of support for the war. There's a rather ugly aspect to politics in Russia at the moment. These are the kinds of things that we need to factor into our own strategic planning. If in that we are in competition, a direct and explicit competition with Moscow, this isn't just about Ukraine, important though that is, and the destruction of Ukraine, which appears to be the target. This is actually about global power competition and Russia positioning itself for that. And that's what I hope the book. While the war is obviously in everyone's mind and the tragedy is in everyone's mind, the war is, as I say, is a subset of that competition, I think, for as far as Moscow is concerned, which is what makes it particularly difficult for us.
This has been a very fascinating discussion, and I think I've taken up enough of your time. Do you have any other concluding thoughts touching on anything we haven't touched on in the discussion?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say thank you for the opportunity to speak and to talk about the book. I really enjoyed our discussion, our exchanges over this. It's I hope you found it interesting to read the book. I always like to thank the contributors to this. It's a little bit unusual for a book on Russia in some sense that I want to try and bring to a wider public audience, in that it's an edited book and we've got some quite senior people in the field writing and contributing in different specific areas. But I hope that this book gives a different angle to the usual Russia question and gives some sense of why we are today where we are. And this is about that sense of Russian power, all its flaws and its flaws alongside its capabilities. So thank you for taking the time to read it and ask me to come and speak to you and to your audience for listening to our session.
Yes. We usually like to finish off by asking our guests, what are you working on now?
Well, thank you. It's two things. There's a lot to work on given the current situation, but I'm just completing another volume on Russian maritime strategy. That's going in as we speak. So looking much more at this conversion of Russia, as we were talking about, you know, not conversion perhaps away from, but this building of Russia as a sea power, as a maritime power, what Russian strategy at sea is. But my current project is a book I'm writing on the Russian way in war, which I sort of tried to begin in 2018, but then was overtaken by work and now I'm coming to anew. So these are the two things that I'm working on, and I'd love to discuss them with you in the future.
Yes, when you get those projects finished, I would love to have you back on the program.
With great pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Monacham, thank you for joining us on the New Books Network.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich, of the Russia and Eurasian Studies channel. Until next time.